evening. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. And along with Mel, K2KEY, Mel and Julie, the three of us run something called the Technical Net. And the main purpose of the Technical Net is to gather the radio amateur clan and share information. We try to help each other understand the somewhat complicated hobby, how do antennas work, and how do feed lines work, and how do transmitters and receivers work, and how do satellites work. There's a lot of stuff. 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. Quite often we discuss the other 25 kinds. The subjects that the TechNet covers are pretty far and wide, because radio amateurs are curious people. They're sort of amateur scientists, and they're interested in many things. So almost anything of interest to a ham radio operator, usually involving electronics and radio and wireless, but not necessarily, those are kind of the subjects that are appropriate for the Technical Net. Mel and Dick run primarily a real-time conversation help session, is what it really is. A very small number of people do write in and get answers, but there's no guarantee. If you decide to write to us because you want free consulting service, there is no guarantee you're going to get an answer. We did not promise that. It's primarily a live give and take, so to speak. Most of the tri-state area, in other words, this particular repeater does have a significant amount of coverage of Long Island, southern New York State, western Connecticut, northern New Jersey. And within that area, there's quite a number of people with a lot of information. They come along, hear the question, and contribute their answers, and that's how it all happens. So Mel and I just try to orchestrate all this jazz. You sign into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick and Julie your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like KE2EJ, Eric, and yes. Please give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick, M2EO, no questions.
W2JPW, Lou, and yes.
So far, we've got Rich with a no and Lou with a yes. Who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2SYL, Bill, yes. KC2MDP, Steve, no questions. Same deck.
Okay, right after KC2MDP, Steve, with a no, we had another person. Who was that?
KC2SYL, Bill, yes.
Yeah, we got Bill, and we got Steve, and who was the other person?
WA2VDH, John, yes.
WS2N, Paul, was no.
Yeah, but you're going to be telling us all what's going on with space. Okay, so far we've got Rich with a no, Lou with a yes, Bill with a yes, Steve with a no, John with a yes. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is N2YJC with a no at this time, but that can always change. How you doing, Dick? Name is Lou.
Think K2KEY.
Very fine, Lou. And there's Mel and Julie. All right, we got more than enough to get started. And Lou is first, W2JPW. What's going on over there in New Jersey, Lou? How you keeping all those hams happy? W2JPW, N2. That's W2JPW, K2RIW.
Oh, good evening, Dick. K2RIW, W2JPW. Oh, boy, look at this thing. I'm looking at my... I'm looking at the wrong meter reading here. Thank you very much. I've got a very prosaic question for you, but it's one that I'm having trouble with. And my wife is after me, big time. I have a lot of old test equipment. I mean, really old. You know, like the old Tektronix 500 series, and lots of plug-ins. I'm just looking for a good home for them. Somebody wants to come and take them off my hands, I'd be very much interested. What I have is specifically is a 556 oscilloscope with two dual trace plugins and lots of other plugins for it. Also a 555, same type of scope, except this one has a separate power supply. The 56 power supply is internal. And I guess I got about 10 plugins. I've got the E's and CA and L and K. I don't know what they all are. I'd have to look. Whole mess of this stuff. And a C12 scope camera, which you can't use anymore because it takes Polaroid packs and they don't make them anymore. I just hate to throw this stuff out, you know. You got any answers for me, Dick? I looked up on the internet, and there's a guy in England who collects them, but that's not going to do me any good. Can you imagine shipping one of these things to England? It would cost more than 10 times more than it's now worth. K2RIW in the group, W2JPW.
Well, you could run the Allendale, New Jersey Museum, but no. Is there a museum that would be interested in that? There are wireless museums, one or two of them on Long Island. There's probably one in New Jersey. And if you do Google the word radio and museum, I think I did do that about a month ago. Somewhere in New Jersey, there is a massive museum of radio equipment. I think it was museum. I think it was New Jersey. I hope it wasn't Maryland. So there's a possibility. A brand new ham radio operator starting off who doesn't have much money, doesn't have to have the latest and the greatest of super compact, all solid state equipment. What you've got there are Tektronix Classics. I also own one of those Polaroid cameras, a scope camera. And I guess I made the mistake of assuming that the Polaroid packs are still available. Considering what digital cameras are like these days, I guess that's kind of naive. Also, to adapt a scope camera to a modern-day digital camera, I'm positive that is possible, Lou. I'm positive that's possible. So, anyone who would like classic Tektronix equipment, like Tektronix 556, 555 scopes, and I've used some of those. I've used the 545. I guess the 555 is probably even a later version. The 545 is a little bit on the massive side, does have an awful lot of tubes, but in its day, it was the highest frequency scope you could use. And I first used one of those, I guess, in the middle 1960s, right around the time that the astronauts were first putting man into space, and we were having suborbital and orbital missions. So, Lou's the guy to get a hold of when you want classic test equipment, W2JPW, in Allendale, New Jersey. Sounds to me, Lou, like the price is right. Sounds like you don't need any money. You're willing to give it away because you do realize it's a little bit obsolete for your modern-day equipment, modern-day operation. But for a person starting off or a person starting or running a museum, I think it's good to know. Anyone have any further suggestions for Lou as to who might like his classic Tektronix and other? Guarantee he's got other pieces of equipment. Give me a call, let us right now if you've got a suggestion. K2RIW and the second half.
K2KEY.
No recognized. Anyone else? Maybe Julie should start a radio museum. Considering what you own, and the fact that her particular city in New Jersey maybe doesn't have an electronic museum. I'm only half kidding when I say that, Mel. K2KEY, go right ahead.
I don't know if she's listening tonight on a scanner. I had a whole garage full of that, and I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, it got to the point where I said, gee, it's going to go to hell laying out there in the garage, all that stuff. So the Kings County Radio Club wanted to raise some money, because we are a non-profit club. We took it to Limark to the one of the ham sets that they have out there in the backyard of the college. And, boy, had a whole carload twice, in fact, did it 2 years in a row. And I cleaned out the garage and got rid of all that test equipment. I had a lot of them, some Tektronix, RCA, Hewlett-Packard stuff and all. And we sold the stuff like for $5 a piece or two for $5 or whatever. We just made sure we didn't let anybody get by without saying, hey, you could use this. And they'd look at it and say, what am I going to do with it? Look at that meter. Look at those knobs. Don't you need a knob? Yeah, I can use that knob. Got to buy the whole. You can use that knob off the front panel? Uh-uh. Got to buy the whole piece of equipment. How much is it? Well, the knob would be $20, but if you buy the whole piece, we give it to you for $5. How could you beat that? So that's what we really did to it. All joking aside, we raised a little money for our club, and at the same time, I cleaned out the garage. The only thing I couldn't part with, why, is still sitting there. And I feel sorry for it, maybe, because I had so much good use out of it. It's a Tektronix 535 scope with the plug-ins and all. It's still sitting down the basement on its cart, but, oh well, I don't know. Just nostalgia, maybe, more than anything, because it was really my first really high-end piece of test equipment, and boy, I sure did a lot with it, Dick, over.
Yeah, I've also developed an emotional attachment to certain pieces of test equipment that I used in the early days. I'm looking for, I think it's an HP3561A, I think it is, Dynamic Signal Analyzer. I'm looking for one of those, because I've used it and really fell in love with it. It's one of a few pieces of rare test equipment, a little bit on the ancient side, but I'd like to have one. I'm trying to remember one other. Some of my Weston meters, you know, in the great big wooden case with the calibration chart inside and whatever. They're so finely made for their day. It's kind of hard to part with some of those. But also, someone did bring to my attention quite a bit of microwave equipment and test equipment. I guess this incident was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I did go to a major flea market of microwave enthusiasts. And believe it or not, Lou, when you tell people it's for free, they're almost afraid to take it. If you tell them it's $2, $3, and $5, and it's a rather large object, all of a sudden they've got interest. They realize it's a bargain. They're spending just enough money to prove that it does have some value to them, as opposed to just taking it and maybe only removing a knob. But believe it or not, if you charge some extremely small value, you may actually sell it at a flea market faster than if you give it away for free. And you can always bargain. When you start off with $5 on something that used to be $5,000, and the guy wants to whittle you down to $3, you can have a grand old time arguing back and forth and settling at $3.10 or $2.95 just for pure fun. So flea market sounds like a good way. Museum is another way. Too bad you don't have a website of some kind that's available to you, Lou, where you could supply photographs. Once there's a website that people can be told about with photographs, that quadruples the interest. Even if it's a little bit ratty looking, the fact that it's a photograph showing exactly what it really is. It's unfortunate that you tell somebody it's a Tektronix 545 Bravo, that particular model number, serial number, such and such, doesn't have quite as much meaning to some people as a photograph. And there are people who use those instruments in the past and would like to own one because they use them professionally. To a person who wants to get a hold of W2JPW, to get a hold of a whole lot of test equipment at nearly zero cost, what's the easiest way they could get a hold of you, Lou? I'm going to guess that you're listed in QRZ.com because I'm looking at it right now. I don't see a website listing on QRZ.com. And you're probably listed in the phone book for Heights Road, Allendale, New Jersey. So a person who is interested in your equipment, what's the easiest way for them to get a hold of you, Lou? W2JPW, great offer, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay.
You could call me. I'll give you my phone number, 201-327-6904. They could get me that way. Or I have to clean out my email now. My email site, Lou N, the letter N is in November, Peggy, at, the symbol at, AOL dot, no, I'm sorry, at Verizon.net. I'm one back here. Lou N, as in November, Peggy, at Verizon.net. Dick, these two scopes, one thing I didn't tell you is they are both dual-beam scopes. They're not like the 535 or the 545, which is a single beam. These are dual scopes. They're dual-beam scopes, which might make them slightly more attractive because it's a comparative rarity even nowadays with the modern stuff. And one of them, I haven't brought them up in years, but you'd have to bring them up on a variac and, do the whole thing. They're in good condition. A little dusty. I have to dust them off, but they've been kept in a dry area. I don't have them in the garage or anything like that. Back to net, W2JPW.
T2YO.
T2YO. Bernie, go right ahead. Your signal's quite noisy, so give us lots of audio and speak slowly.
I just wanted to let you know there is a group on the internet that is going to start manufacturing Polaroid film in 2010.
Okay, so there's a group on the internet that's going to start manufacturing Polaroid film. 2010. That's good to know. Nowadays, if I want to take a picture of the front panel, I think I would do it with a digital camera. I'm not so sure I'd want to do it with Polaroid anymore, even though I still own at least one and maybe two Polaroid scope cameras. Was there someone else that wanted to say something? Okay. So, Lou, W2JPW, has got a pair of dual-beam scopes, 555 with all kinds of plug-ins, and 556 with all kinds of plug-ins. 201-327-6904, if I got that right. And his email address is Lou November Peggy, P-E-G-G-I-E, I'm going to guess. So it's Lou N. Peggy, where the N is just the letter N, at Verizon.net. Do I have that somewhat correct, Lou? Go ahead.
P-E-G-G-Y, Dick. Peggy, P-E-G-G-Y. It's my wife's name is Margaret, but it's Peggy for short, so that's what we have on our internet address. And, all the rest is correct. Go ahead.
Good thing you corrected me on that. I should have realized that's the spelling for, I think, a male name instead of a female name. Okay. The price is right. That's Lou. Next person who signed in with a real question is Bill, KC2, Sierra Yankee, Lima. Go right ahead, Lou, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
And Dick, I got a question, WS2N. A quick question about that scope.
Stand by, Bill. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I heard Mel mention plugins, and then you mentioned it. I think Lou did too. What are these plugins when you refer to these oscilloscopes? I've got a whole heat kit scope here, but what do you mean by a plugin?
Okay, some of the versions of the Tektronix scope had a reasonably large mainframe, let's say, for instance, with two beams to it. And on the lower left-hand side, you can plug in a timing unit. On the lower right-hand side, you can plug in units which have either dual input or single input and chopper control, high gain, low frequency, or low gain, high frequency, or high sensitivity, high frequency. They had various kinds of plugins. And so let's let Lou give a couple of words on what some of those various plugins did do. Go ahead, Lou, W2JPW, K2RIW.
Okay, K2RIW in the group, W2JPW. The plugins, I'd have to open the cabinet and go through them all, but I've got a lot of them. I have several, I have to go look and see what 185, I think they are, dual trace plugins. Both of these scopes have two time bases, and they're actually two scopes in one. You could bring up eight or as many as four traces, or I guess if you have the right plug-in, you could bring up eight even, but four traces on CRT. They're old, but they're quite sophisticated. They'll do almost anything if you really put the time and learn how to use them and get them up and running. We have high rise, very fast rise time plug-in, at least for that day and age. I have these very low-level type E plug-ins. They're down to 10 microvolts. They're good for low-frequency work. I use them a great deal when I used to do a lot of experimenting with looking at very, very tiny signals at low frequencies. One of the best differential amplifiers that ever was made, as far as I was concerned. I tried others, and nothing ever worked quite as well as that plug-in did. Whether you use it in a scope or use it in a separate power supply, which I also have. I haven't used that in years either. But I did a lot 30, 40 years ago with all of this stuff. I don't do anything with it anymore, just gathering dust here. So there are fast rise time plugins, there are low signal level plugins, there are multiple trace plugins, and God knows I got a couple of others that I haven't even thought about in years. Go ahead, Dick.
Fantastic. By the way, 10 microvolts per centimeter, that is a scope sensitivity. Wow. Many a scope doesn't go much below a few millivolts per centimeter. 10 microvolts per centimeter. On top of that, some of these scope plugins or scopes themselves will have not only an input connector but an output connector so that you can use it as a preamplifier, and it's a preamplifier where you can set the gain. In other words, as you adjust the knob that tells you 10 microvolts per centimeter, 50, 100, 500 microvolts per centimeter, and so on, as you adjust the main knob, it really is simultaneously setting the amount of deflection on the screen, as well as the gain of that stage between the front panel and the back panel, if there is a connector on the back panel. So sometimes you can use them that way. Many of the Tektronix scope had a delayed sweep function to it also, where you could sweep across a complex waveform, like, say, for instance, an old-fashioned television picture with its 525 lines, and by way of a dial where you could set the time delay, you could decide to synchronize on the main vertical sync or the main vertical sync and look at the horizontal line number 241 and expand just that particular line across the screen with the delayed sweep function. So they got some real fancy Tektronix for a lot of years set the state of the art in oscilloscopes. Hewlett-Packard tried very hard and didn't quite come up to Tektronix standards from my point of view. Hewlett-Packard did a better job on spectrum analyzers, but Tektronix always did a much better job on oscilloscopes. So although this is a somewhat ancient piece of equipment, it's still got an awful lot of capability. What, if you've got any further questions on that, Paul? Sounds to me like you're getting a little bit envious, and sounds to me like there's a slim possibility you're going to take a trip to Allendale, New Jersey, which isn't too far over the bridge. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, like I say, I have this old Heath kit that I still use, and just was curious about these, you know, what they meant by the plug-ins. It sounds like, I can't believe what was going on in the 50s and 60s. Wow. Amazing. Especially with the plugins that he's got. Very interesting, Dick. Just curious. No, I'm not gonna get that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Anyone else with any further questions or need for fill-ins for this great offer that Lou has made? W2JPW is offering a number of very nice vintage high-class oscilloscopes for a few decades ago. They're not quite modern, but the price is right. And if I know Lou, he's got other pieces of the test equipment. If you're a person that's sufficiently interested, I'll bet you he'll open up another portion of his radio museum. It's like Mel and Vic have a radio museum, so does Lou. Anybody have any further questions or fills? Give me your call letters right now. And apparently not. Okay. And come back next week and repeat the offer if you don't get any nibbles between now and then, Lou. Also, the flea market approach, I think you're going to find a lot of success there. Because that's a gathering of people who are usually not looking for the latest and the greatest. They're looking for older things. Bill, KC2SYL. Go right ahead, Bill. K2RIW.
K2RIW. Good evening, Dick, and good evening to other Annette listeners this evening. Now, I'm a new ham, and I fall into one of the categories, I know you discussed towards the end of the net on the Sunday evenings. But I recently purchased a Yaesu Model 817 low-power QRP rig, and I have in my home, I can only use an upstairs bedroom for a modified Radio Shack. I actually have to break down the items, for certain times. The question I have for the low-power rig is, if I just take a random wire, piece of wire, say 18 gauge, drop it out the second floor window, it's about 15 feet to the ground, and extend that another 30 feet on the ground to the sidewalk, what do I have to be aware of to use that for transmitting? I understand I can listen okay on that, and I've tried that, and that seems to work, but I'm a little concerned about listening. And I understand the concept of the tuning and so on, but I'm just trying to develop a strategy here. Back to you, Dick.
As an experiment, a QRP rig usually means it puts out 5 watts or less. A person could hold on to that wire with his hand while you're transmitting, and he would not be injured. So it's extremely safe when you run that lower power. That power is being spread over a lot of feet of wire, whereas a handy talkie on 2 meters might run 5 watts, and that power is just spread over 4 inches of rubber duck, if you know what I mean. So power flux density is going to be a very low number, so it's very safe. When it comes to impedance matching, a piece of wire drop down 15 feet and then run 30 feet along the ground, that would be 45 feet total, and would that resonate on 40 meters because of the capacitive loading of the ground it's against? The answer is probably yes. QRP rigs are reasonably forgiving if you've got a high standing wave ratio. I don't think anything bad will happen. In the ideal world, you'd like to be using an antenna tuner. With an antenna tuner, the right antenna tuner that's got enough range to it, any old piece of wire can be forced into resonance. There are specific lengths of wire, there are specific altitudes of wire that'll work a little bit better. If you had a way of taking that wire from the second floor of the house, running it the right length, and the right length depends on what band you're on and what harmonic of that band you want to run the wire at. At the end of that wire, 18 gauge is a good piece of wire, put a piece of black thread or dark string or whatever and run it over to a tree, a telephone pole, or any other support structure. Make the wire fine enough. If it was enameled wire and it was 28 gauge, 30 gauge, it would be essentially invisible. And then with a black piece of thread at the far end of it, run it over to a telephone pole, a tree, or whatever. You'll get a little bit more performance that way. It's nice to have altitude. The so-called Herbie Snake antenna. Herbie was a ham radio operator from this particular repeater group, the Limelight repeater group, who had some extremely strict rules in his town that he's not allowed any antennas. Well, he made an antenna that consisted of coax cable with slots cut into it in the right places, and it laid flat on his lawn, and he operated on 20 meters. He wasn't the strongest signal in the world, but he got out and made contacts. So altitude always does help. Be aware, though, that when you're running a piece of wire outside the house, do not run it anywhere near power lines. Be very careful about that. Even though it's a fine gauge piece of wire, it could get you into quite a bit of trouble. So avoid the power lines. other than that, a fine piece of wire, suspended in all kinds of ways when it comes to stealthy antennas. There's whole books on just that subject. There's a million ways you can do it. No particular way is more magic than another if you've got an antenna tuner. Even if you don't have an antenna tuner, give it a try. You're not going to get in very much trouble. But with an antenna tuner, you can force the matching to be a lot better, and you'll get more performance. I wouldn't lay it across the ground unless I really had to. I would try to suspend the wire, even if I got to run it around the perimeter of the house and drape it across the roof or run it along the shingles and hold it up with thumbtacks. There's lots and lots of ways you can do it. I'm going to pass it over to Mel, because I bet you he's run into questions like this before. I mean, there's all kinds of pieces of wire around his house that are hard to see, that are radiating radio signals. So what would you suggest, Mel, for John, correction, Bill? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I want to see if anybody else wanted to join us via the internet or whatever. The 817, FT817 Yaesu, just finished up working on one a few weeks ago. In fact, I just made the final modifications on it. It was one of my rescues from the garbage pail, literally. One step from being put out with the trash. Nice radio, bit on the costly side for a QRP rig initially, but I would never run that into a high SWR. Even though it does have the facility to fold back the power. From working on that radio and then listening and looking on the internet, different comments on that radio, it can be a problem child. You've got to be very careful. So many people have had problems with that radio, burning it out by inadvertently maybe reversing the power supply even on the 12-volt supply. Initially for just a touch will kill the radio. The radio internally actually operates on no more than needs. It actually doesn't need more than about around 10 volts input. Does not need the full 12 volts input. In fact, anything over around 10 volts really makes those regulators in there work pretty hard, because they're all, the whole radio internally is basically operating either at the or about 9 volts or 5 volts after the regulator, so you're just heating up the regulators and all. So it will get kind of hot. That's why I made the modification, putting an external regulator and fusing, and then also the prevention, a reverse battery or a reverse power input mistake and ruining the radio. Also, the regulator will hold it down so that the voltage actually going into the radio does not exceed about 10.5. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll say something about antennas. The antenna that I would suggest you need to use on that, like you say, Dick, you can make a very nice thin little dipole up for it with thin wire and use it that way. Simple dipole, hard to see if you can. Basically, for that QRP rig, you can, make up something using number 22 gauge or whatever wire. Almost impossible to see from, especially ground level, if it's 20 feet up at least, in a tree or whatever. So, and use mini feed line, mini 8U or whatever as a feed line or whatever. You're better off to do that. If you're going to insist on fooling around with high SWRs and other things, rather than look to ruin that radio, damage it, which will be very costly to repair. I had spoken to Yaesu, if I didn't do the home repair on this thing, it would not have paid six because of what had happened to it. Get yourself a tuner then. Get yourself an outboard tuner, at least. Whatever you're doing, you can at least give the radio something to match into that's not going to show a high SWR. People are under the misunderstanding that if you have a QRP radio that you have to have a QRP antenna. you're just actually making it almost impossible to make a contact. And you got to look for the best antenna possible, especially when you're running QRP. Dick, I think that's the best advice I can give them. So try to do your best and not some kind of real compromised antenna that even at higher power most likely wouldn't do very much for you. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, you feel that the final stage is a little on the delicate side. You wouldn't run it for a long period of time into a high standing wave ratio antenna. Is that somewhat what I think you're saying, among many other things? But I think you're saying you would be a little bit cautious about that final stage seeing less than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Is that one way of stating it? Mel, go ahead.
Having just replaced that final stage also, one of the other, one of the repairs on that radio, the final stage, the way it's laid out, it's always on the incoming line. And it seems like it'd be easily damaged. And the fact, according to the information I got on the internet on the 817, that these radios have failed when they even use the power supply that is basically a switching power supply that for if approximately 0.25 nanoseconds of a surge when you put that radio on and it exceeds about, say, about 14, 15 volts in that neighborhood, if that peak is for just a couple of microseconds, shows up or whatever, it will ruin that radio. It's a good possibility that radio will be destroyed. So they recommended it. Yes, it was one of the fixes. It's to run it off batteries, run it off a gel cell, a 10.5 volt gel cell, or the internal batteries. And but if you're going to insist on running it off a power supply, a switching power supply, to add in the additional protection circuit on the back of the radio as it was outlined. In fact, in QST, Dick, over.
Interesting. I'm a little bit amazed that Yesu would make something as delicate as that. Okay, good advice. Looks like your conservativeness up till now, Bill, of only using it in the receiving mode and not transmitting, looks like it's well recommended. Hmm. Well, another good thing for you to know, Bill, is that even if at worst something happens and a regulator or a final stage is requiring a replacement, you can tell by getting onto a net like this one, you'll find people that will help you repair it, and repairing it may not be anywhere near as bad as you think. You go to the tune-up clinics that Andy runs, WA2CDL, you'll also get some very good advice there. And so, one way or another, just about every piece of ham radio equipment that is a commercial product, and some of them that are homebrew, are thoroughly repairable if you got the right friends. So don't let some of these delicate functions that we just described to you scare the daylights out of you. If at worst something happens, if you send it back to Yesu, maybe it's going to be expensive, but if you repair it yourself or with the help of your friends, it doesn't have to be expensive. KC2SYL, let us know what you decide on that antenna and come back and describe it to us, Bill. K2RIW, you got it, Bill.
Thanks, Mel. Thanks, Dick. I did call Yesu when I bought the piece of equipment. Actually, I bought it secondhand from eBay. And Yesu advised not to use the switching power supply. And according to the manual, I need at least a 3-amp regulated power supply, which I do not have. My initial experimentation or my initial use of the rig is to use it solely on battery. And that would satisfy my needs, you know, as I'm learning. And in terms of the antenna out the window and on the lawn, I would just retrieve it, at the end of the session and just bring it back in the house. And I have several other questions, if I may, regarding antennas, regarding Yagi antennas, and how you determine what frequency they're aligned to, and the possibility of putting antenna in the attic. Right now, I don't have the ability to put the antenna fast into the outside of the house, so I'd just like to discuss that, if that's okay. This is KC2SYL, back to next.
Yeah, Yeah, go ahead with that other antenna question and wait for the beep.
Okay, when we purchased the house many years ago, there was an outside TV antenna on a roof, a pretty majestic one. And attached to that post is also a Yagi antenna. Several questions. The Yagi is pointed towards the Empire State Building, and so is the TV antenna. Would I be able to use the TV antenna? I know this is a basic question. I should know the answer to it. But if I had the appropriate tuner, would I be able to use the TV antenna for the low-power rig? And the second question is for the Yagi antenna. How would it determine what frequency, it's tuned to? I could look at the elements, count the elements from the ground, from the sidewalk, but I really can't get up on a roof because of various reasons. Back to net.
Okay, when it comes to a television aerial, and that's what I think you're saying, the one that's aimed at Empire State Building, for people like Mel and I, who were some of the last people left on planet Earth that are not using cable television or a fiber television or whatever, or DirecTV KU band listening, we listen to nothing but over-the-air broadcast television. But we put up good antennas so we get the lots of channels. I watch both New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut channels by over-the-air broadcast. A television aerial, even though it used to be made for analog television, can you use it on digital television today, over-the-air broadcast? Absolutely. And it should work like a charm in most cases, particularly if it's got both the upper VHF and UHF capability. To use a television aerial on ham radio is a bit difficult. I would say it won't work, and you could put fancy tuners in there and force it to work, but the performance is not going to be great. The frequencies are pretty different. Your television goes from channel 2 at 54 megacycles up to channel 6 at 88 megacycles, then it jumps from channel 7, which is 174, up to channel 13, which is around 212, I think it is. And then channel 14 UHF starts off at 470. So you can see there's great big gaps in there. The ham radio frequencies are in those gaps, and the television aerial is not designed for any of those frequencies. Yes, there are ways you could retune it, but I don't recommend it. When it comes to a Yagi that was a ham radio VHF, UHF Yagi, measuring the length of the driven element and the length of the directors will tell you right away what band it's on. If those elements are in the vicinity of 12 inches long, which is half wave at 432, it's a 432 antenna. If the elements are around 3 feet long, 38 inches, then it's a 2-meter antenna. If the elements are closer to, 9 feet long, then it's a 6-meter Yagi. So measuring the length of the elements, and there's great big gaps in there. I mean, when you go from 9 feet long elements on 6 meters to roughly 3 foot long elements on 2 meters to roughly 1 foot long elements on 432, that's pretty easy to tell, even if you're not there with a ruler. A smart guy can say, okay, that chimney that it's mounted to is 25 feet above the ground. I'm standing 25 feet off to one side. That means the actual slant range between me and it is square root of 2 times 25. Maybe the answer comes out to 36 feet. And from 36 feet away, with my thumb held out at arm's length, I can figure out how many degrees. If my thumb can just barely cover up the antenna from tip to tip, by triangulation, as you can tell, there's various ways that you can easily come to the estimation of the elements 9 feet, 3 feet, or 1 feet long. Those are the two most popular bands for VHF, UHF, Yagis. Once you know the element length for the driven element in particular, you know what band it's on. So that's about the easiest way I can think of, Bill. Back to you. KC2SYL, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Thanks, Dick. I think it was put up by the previous owner to monitor, to receive HBO signals.
If you recall, at one time, I think HBO, if you had the proper antenna, was free, or maybe had to pay for the subscription to receive it on a TV, you know, TV receiver. I'm talking about 25, 30 years ago. And that's how old the antenna is, approximately 25 years old. I can't eyeball it. I didn't count the elements today, but I can get an idea. But I do suspect it was to receive those TV signals, probably HBO or something similar to that. And the larger antenna, yes, it does receive UHF and DHF. And there are two separate leads. I just have to determine which lead is which.
Understand. The HBO antenna worked at a roughly 2.1 gigahertz. And there the elements are more like 3 or so inches long. And that's in many cases, the elements look like a bunch of washers on a great big long pole. It's called a Simon antenna or a cigar antenna. And unless you're on the 2300 ham radio, 2300 megacycle ham radio band, you're not going to get a lot of use out of that particular antenna. And that's what it originally was. The so-called wireless cable TV or over-the-air subscription service that they had 10, 15, 20 years ago. HBO was one of them, and there were two or three others. Many of them worked at 2.1 gigahertz, that so-called license-free band. And back in the old days, it was an educational set of frequencies. Wideband distribution, I think it was called. So, let us know what you discover on those antennas when we talk to you next week, Bill. Next person who signed in with a question was John, KV2 Victor Delta Hotel. Go right ahead, John, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, fine. This is Dick. Say good evening to you and good evening to the net. My question has to do with surface mount technology, more specifically soldering techniques. I was wondering if anybody on the net or if you've had any experience with the hot air soldering of surface mount components. I was looking at some of these surface mount rework systems, and a lot of them include a hot air soldering system as well as the conventional soldering system. So I'm thinking of looking into something like that. Also, I was wondering if you had any experience. I noticed in QST there was an article about a year ago, I think, on a homebrew surface mount rework system. Don't remember the name of the article, what issue it was in. Anyway, just curious what your thoughts are on it. Back to Ned.
Now, because I do prototyping work as an occupation, as a consultant, I'm working with surface mount components essentially every day. To me, the most valuable instrument required to do a good job with surface mount at the modeling level, I mean, the answer I'm going to give you is different than if you were in a production run and you got a pick-and-place machine and you're building 1,000 PC boards. The answer would be very different from the onesie, twosies I build as a modeling and a proof of concept operation. But to me, the most valuable instrument is a stereo zoom microscope. You've got to be able to see the components. You got to be able to see the solder, the printed circuit board, and the modern-day surface mount components come in extremely small sizes. 0603 is about the biggest anyone uses these days. That 60 thou by 30 thou is the component size. And they go all the way down to 0201, which means 20,000 by 10,000. When you see a plastic bag full of 0201 surface mount resistors, it looks like grains of sand inside of a plastic package. And without a microscope, you're not going to make it. I will admit that back when I was 18 years of age and I was very nearsighted and I could focus on the tip of my nose, I could put my nose up against a printed circuit board. I was getting a magnified view because my eyes would focus that close. And in those days, I probably didn't need a microscope. Anything beyond 25 or 30 years of age, forget it. You got to have a microscope to be able to see it. And the best kind is a stereo zoom microscope, a microscope where you can tune the magnification. And when you're starting to buy one of those microscopes used, your first intention is going to be very similar to a person. Let me drop. Your very first impression is going to be like a person buying his first telescope. You think the bigger the gain number, the better. I mean, if somebody was going to buy a telescope with a gain number of 100 and a slightly more expensive one is gain of 300, you'd be very tempted to buy the 300. You'd be doing the wrong thing. Because in the case of a telescope, measure the number of inches of the forward piece of glass, if it's a refractor, and whatever that number of inches is, multiply it by 60. If your telescope has got a 2-inch forward piece of glass, 120 is the highest gain you can use. Anything beyond that, you just get a blurry picture. 60 times the number of inches. Well, there's something similar going on with a microscope. Rarely do you need more than a gain of about 20 or so, or 30 with a microscope. So if you could zoom between 10 and 35, numbers like that is more than enough for a microscope. If you've got the right kind of lighting, that way you can see the work. After that, there's a skill set required for you to use little dabs of glue to hold down the component temporarily, little pieces of wood with a sharp point on the end of the little wooden stick to hold down the component, a small soldering iron. One of the problems you've got with surface mount components is that if you were trying to solder down a component and you've got it in exactly the right position and you've got the 064 diameter solder in your left hand and a very fine tipped soldering iron in the right hand, and you try to solder down that particular lead to the printed circuit board, the solder will flow very nicely. The component is now soldered to the board. You pick up the soldering iron, and the component, because of capillary action, follows the soldering iron. So unless you're holding down that component, the solder wicking function will pick that component back up off the board. So putting down components is a bit of an art form to doing that. The tiddlywink problem will drive you up a wall. You'll have a nice fine piece of tweezers, you're holding onto this component, and the component slips a little bit off to one edge of the tweezers, and the component goes flying, and it goes to outer space as far as you're concerned. Unless you build a moat around the work you're doing, you're going to lose that component. You better hope you've got some spares, because to find a 0201 component that has gone flying off your tweezers and it landed on a clean, clear tile floor, your chances of finding it are near zero. And if your floor and your bench is at all cluttered, like mine, forget it. Go get another component. So you have to anticipate those problems. Unsoldering old components from a printed circuit board, you want to use solder wicking material. Hold down the component by some technique with the soldering iron and the solder wicking material, which looks like a copper braid. You suck off all of the solder around the leads, and then you can remove the component. Yes, if you're doing a whole lot of that work, a hot air blowing gun would help, and a solder sucking tool would help. But I'm not sure you're doing that kind of production requiring that many large pieces of components. Now, that's the way I do modeling with surface mount components. Other people do it other ways. I'm going to pass it over to the net, have anyone else give us their suggestion as to how to solder down and unsolder surface mount components on a printed circuit board. What's your favorite way of doing it, and what do you recommend? Give me a call at us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
B2KEY.
Mel recognized. Is there anyone else? Looks like it's you, Mel. I bet you've done a fair amount of surface mounts, and let's see how you do it. Hope you've got a nice microscope. Yes, you can do it with one of these very large magnifying glasses with a very bright light. That works, and some people use eye loops, magnification they put on their head, and that sort of works. But the stereo zoom microscope is a much more Cadillac approach, in my opinion. But not everyone ever agrees with me. Over to you, Mel.
Something tells me I may have to look for one of them, because getting more and more of that, this is something that's not going to go away, SMT. And the components, like you say, are kind of very small. I just finished up, as I was saying just previous, on that Yaesu FT1817, which you said something goes wrong with it. Let me tell you something, Dick. That was a a project to repair it, a real project. That's why they get so much money to repair them. They won't even do component testing on that radio. This is an extremely compact all-band radio, all-mode, with many menus. The amount of menus, there's 45 menus on this radio, plus sub-menus. And they jammed all this in from 160 to 70 centimeters, upper side, lower side band, gritty, you name it. It's a very nice little radio. But to work on it, oh boy, no wonder they at Yaesu told me, if you have to do any repair on it, we'll sell you new boards. That's what we do. Don't go to the component level. In fact, when I needed components and called them up, they couldn't help me. They recommended I go to DigiKey. So, basically, as you said, you got to work in a moat. You got to build yourself a moat. And you need a third hand. You've got to have these gadgets that I came up with, like you mentioned, that'll hold it, an arm that'll hold the component in place while you solder it. How I take even the component off the board is with the wick and everything, and then with this special little locking tweezers that I have, and a rubber band connected to it and holding that in my teeth, so that as soon as the solder, working even with two small irons, as soon as I lift, you know, get the component loose, I can just pull my head up and lift the component. It takes practice. That's the bottom line, Dick. But it's a challenge to repair, do component level, down to the component level repair on SMT technology, Dick, over.
Fantastic. Good information, Mel. The miniature world behaves very different than common sense. You're looking under a microscope. You've placed down this surface mount resistor or capacitor. It's either 60 thou or 40 thou or 20 thou or 10 thou in major size, thousandths of an inch. And without the microscope gain, you're not going to get a good view of it. So you got the component down on the board. You want to solder it. And you realize it's a couple thousandths of an inch, a little bit too far to the south. So you take your sharp-pointed little wooden dowel, the end of one of these long industrial-type cotton swab machine things, and you sharpen one end of it, and you reach down there and you try to push the component a couple thou to the north because it's a little bit too far to the south. And you start pushing with that stick, and you expect it to move a couple of thou. At first it doesn't move, and then when it does move, it jumps 10,000ths of an inch. You say to yourself, why the hell did it do that? The micro-miniature world is persnickety. It takes a skill set. You want to move it, most likely you're better off doing it with a gentle set of tweezers. I say gentle because you squeeze it real hard. You're not going to damage it. But if it happens to slip out of the tweezers while the tweezers are being squeezed hard, it will go to the end of the earth. It will fly into space as far as you're concerned. And you'll never see that component again. The micro-miniature world is quite frustrating at first. So there's a real skill set. So I suspect that some of the answers you're getting, John, are a little bit different than you expected. But magnification first, small soldering irons and ways of holding things down second. And when it comes to hot air guns for doing the soldering or the desoldering, unless you're doing large production runs, I don't think you need that. And the large soldering, the large hot air gun, if you had it, once the component gets loose enough, once the solderer melts with that gun, it's going to blow the component away. And it'll again go flying off to the ends of the earth. So it's a hard way to go. Maybe some of these will help. My guess is there's got to be a website somewhere that if you Google the right search words, you'll find a lot of information about recommended procedures for soldering and desoldering components of a surface mount capability on modern-day circuits. And nowadays, the density of these circuits, wow. If somebody is throwing away a cell phone, I strongly recommend you grab it out of the garbage and take it apart. And you will get an eye-opening you won't believe. When you see the level of...
At 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
that's advertising this particular tech net. When you see the level of integration that's going on with surface mount super miniature components and 7 and 14 layer printed circuit boards and whatever, and very fancy connectors and switches and push buttons and whatever, when you see what's inside a modern cell phone, which they may call it third generation, but in my mind it's fourth generation, it is quite an eye-opening. Do it. It'll teach you an awful lot. Back to you, John. To me, 2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business, Dick. As a matter of fact, that was really thing I was wondering about, is that some of these ICs, when I look at the pin spacing, it just seems that it would be impossible to actually touch an iron to those pins and solder them. That even if you did manage to heat them up, I mean, you would get all kinds of solder bridges and everything. Whereas the hot air system, it seems inherently it would clear out the interpin spacing of solder and leave only solder on the pins and on the pads for the pins. That's why I was wondering about the hot air soldering system. But I see a point as needing something to hold down the item, sort of a third hand to keep the item and keep the part in place as you're soldering it. So I'm going to do some more research on this because this came about from doing some repair work just needing some of these things soldered. I think the same problem that Mel was facing, and it was something that when I looked at it, I just thought I wouldn't attempt it. Back to you, Dick.
I got some comments, WHCDL, and some suggestions.
Okay, I'm going to go over to Andy in about 2 minutes. If you're using fine enough solder, 064 diameter solder, or is it 032, but the finer solder they make, if the tip of your soldering iron is sharpened enough, you can do it with an old-fashioned Unger soldering iron and sharpen the tip with a file and make it a very fine point, or buy the appropriate soldering iron that has a fine point. So with a fine enough point on the soldering iron and small enough diameter solder, and even if your solder is not small enough in diameter, you can pound it with a hammer and cut it into strips. There's various ways you can make fine solder. With proper magnification, fine solder, and a sharp tip, you'll have no trouble getting in between the individual leads of the integrated circuit and then soldering them down once you have developed the skill. When it comes to desoldering one of these chips that's got 64 wires coming out of the side that all go down to a printed circuit board, there's a very interesting skill for doing that. You take a piece of stainless steel, so-called aircraft wire, and remove one single strand of the stainless steel. Snake that under all of the leads along one of the faces of the integrated circuit. Let's assume that it's got 20 leads on each one of the four sides, so it's got 60 leads total. And you snake that piece of stainless steel wire under the 20 leads on one side. Then you heat up each individual lead. As you pull the stainless steel wire forward, it will pull away the solder, and it will lift that particular lead. And one lead at a time, as you go down there with the soldering iron, you'll pick up every one of those leads with that stainless steel wire. And the stainless steel wire, the solder won't stick to it. Therefore, it will not solder itself to the wires or to the board, to the leads or to the board. So there's all kinds of fancy skills. Do you really need a hot air gun? I don't think so, but let's see what Andy. Andy works with surface mount components. Let's see how he does it. W2CDL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening. How you doing, guys? It's been a while. I happen to be in the car. I just pulled into the driveway. And I got to get ready for work tomorrow again. Happy holidays to all. One of the things that you're neglecting, which is very important, is called the ESD, electrostatic sensitive devices. And whenever my suggestion is, and Dick, I think you'll agree with this, whenever you work on any surface mount component, you should wear a wrist strap and make sure that you're grounded to a good ground through a conductive, either conductive mat that you're stepping on, or conductive chair, or even a conductive foam rubber workbench, because these